From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. In the wake of the destruction from the cyclone that has killed over 22,000 people in Myanmar, we will talk about how relief is getting through in that country that has been closed off for so many years, and we'll also talk about the upcoming referendum that is up for a vote this weekend. All about Myanmar in the hour ahead. Join us here on KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. In what is being tallied as the greatest natural disaster in Asia since the 2004 tsunami, Myanmar, formerly known as the Nation of Burma, was hit on Monday by a major cyclone that killed over 22,000 people and left tens of thousands homeless and short on food and water. The military regime of the country is moving forward nonetheless with this Saturday's planned constitutional referendum. And in this morning's opening hour, we want to update you on Myanmar. First, we want to go, in fact, to talk to Richard Horsey, who is a spokesman for the Regional United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs in Bangkok. He joins us by phone this morning from Bangkok. And welcome, Richard Horsey. Good to have you with us.
Thanks.
I guess I'd like to begin by getting an update from you on what is getting through in the way of humanitarian aid that we know of and what is not. The borders are somewhat more open, are they not?
Well, yes, I think the major problem right now is not getting relief goods from outside the country into the airport at Yangon. It's really the distribution from there to the communities that are in desperate need of this stuff. That's where the bottleneck is, and that's where we're focusing our efforts in terms of beefing up the capacity and the possibility of delivering this aid.
We were told that the United Nations had a green light to send in a team to assess the damage there and that they would pull out all stops, really, to send in food and clean water and blankets and plastic sheeting.
Sure. The various agencies of the United Nations have identified strategic stockpiles of the essential goods in the region. There are planes ready to go. We can get those goods in fairly large quantities in quite quickly. But the major problem is accessing these remote areas in the delta where traveling is very, very difficult.
And at this point, do we know how many people have died and how many people are homeless? We're hearing a lot of different figures.
Well, in terms of those impacted but still alive, I mean, the ones that we're focusing on, at least 1 million people are in urgent need of life-saving assistance, shelter, clean water, and then basic medical kits and mosquito nets. In terms of the death toll, this is the government authorities that are compiling that, and the figures are quite alarming. 22,500 reported to be confirmed as dead and another 41,000 missing. And these numbers are continuing to climb as the authorities get their first access to the worst affected areas, which have been unreachable up until this point.
What about those areas? I mean, clean water and food needs to get through, particularly to these far-flung areas. How can it be done? And can the government, which has been certainly not as active as they have been in crackdowns politically, as far as helping, at least from all the criticism that has been coming at them. How can they help?
Yeah, I mean, it's transportation logistics that is urgently needed at this point. The government authorities have pledged a number of helicopters and a number of boats to the relief effort. And that's obviously critical in terms of reaching these affected areas. But many of these areas are almost completely underwater, and so it is very, very hard, even with good equipment, to get aid there. In terms of clean water, the priority and the focus is on water purification tablets and so on, rather than transporting water itself. Although in some areas inundated with storm surge from the sea, the water around there is saline and therefore not drinkable, even with purification tablets.
We're talking with Richard Horsey. He's with us from Bangkok. He's a spokesman for the Regional United Nations Office for Coordinating Humanitarian Aid in Myanmar. Mr. Horsey, the New York Times today highlighted how the infrastructure, particularly in some of these areas that are so difficult to access, has been degraded to begin with before the cyclone hit. That is, dikes collapsing and irrigation systems failing and bridges impassable. That makes it all the more difficult, I presume, and presents even greater problems.
Absolutely, but I have to say that in these delta areas, whatever had been the state of the infrastructure before, they're essentially underwater now. So the best roads in the world wouldn't have helped some of these areas. But it's true that the quality of the infrastructure we're dealing with was bad to begin with. And so as you can imagine, it is a significant challenge to get the necessary goods delivered to where they're needed.
Well, there are many people listening to this program who would like to help. The First Lady, Laura Bush, said she's worried that Myanmar won't even accept U.S. aid. What can people do here in the United States? What would you suggest?
Well, right now, the international side of the equation has mobilized fairly quickly, and so my concern is not so much how do we get the goods to Yangon. I think that's the easier part, in a sense, and we're getting a handle more easily on that. It's rather, getting the delivery to those remote areas.
Mr. Horsey, good luck to you, and high marks and commendation for the work that you've done here. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
It's Richard Horsey, who is spokesman for the regional UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs in Bangkok. We're also going to go to Joseph Silverstein, professor emeritus at Rutgers and the author of a number of books on Burma, now Myanmar, who is joining us from Princeton, New Jersey. And Professor Silverstein, welcome to you. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Glad to have you actually back with us. At this point, what does all this mean as you see it with respect to the referendum that's scheduled for this Saturday? The government wants to go ahead with it, clearly.
Well, that's still the order of the day, although they've already announced that there will be no elections in 47 townships in the Rangoon area, where one of the largest concentrations of people are, because that's the area that was so badly hit. Rangoon is in the Delta region. It's not at the coast, but certainly bad. If you take into account that the heart of the cyclone hit and launched a 12-foot tidal wave into the country. That's where all the damage occurred from, and that's going to take a long time to get straightened out.
Well, we should mention the government has officially said, the Myanmar government, that those areas won't have elections this weekend, that they'll be postponed until the 24th of May, but the government seems to want to press ahead with this referendum.
You're sure they do, because they've already got it half counted. The ballots have been marked. They're ready to distribute them, and they are taking or want to take no chances that they lose this election as they lost the election in 1990.
The Nobel laureate, whom you've written about, Aung San Suu Kyi, has said that the government should not press ahead under these circumstances.
Any sensible government would have canceled or postponed. After all, the people haven't had a chance to read the Constitution. It isn't widely distributed. Everyone knows, however, from 18 years of talking about the writing of the Constitution, that it will give the Burmese military absolute control forever in the country. And so, therefore, they want to put this into writing. They want to have an endorsement, and they want, therefore, to say, now we've got all the opportunity and the rights to do what we do.
Well, I made a bit of an editorial comment before when I said they were government seemed to be a lot more ardent at cracking down on monks than it appears to be lending the kind of assistance that many people have wanted at this point and need desperately at this point. It seems, in fact, that there's been a sense of turmoil against the regime as a result of the cyclone. I don't know if you can gauge this at this point, but by
absolutely. I'm following the reporting coming out of Thailand, where a number of Burmese in exile have put together some of the best news reporting that we get out of Burma. And there's no question, because what was outstanding at the beginning was there was no soldiers, there was no police, there were no emergency people to take to the streets and give the people direction and help. The comparison that's being made is that in September, the military was quick to come out to the street with its weapons and shoot and brutalize the monks and anybody that wanted to help them. But now in this national disaster, they aren't out there, and they still aren't out there from any of the reporting that I'm reading.
Again, Professor Emeritus Joseph Silverstein from Princeton, New Jersey, joining us, who is Professor Emeritus at Rutgers and the author of Political Legacy of Aung San Suu Kyi and Burmese Politics, The Dilemma of National Unity. We want to go now to Maureen Aung Thuyen, who is director of the Burma Project, Southeast Asian Initiative, and she joins us from New York City. And welcome, Ms. Aung Thuyen.
Hi. Thank you.
We're talking with Professor Silverstein about the government, Myanmar's slowness in responding. And we also ought to mention here, I'd like to have you comment on that, but also mention here that they weren't exactly very responsive in putting out warnings about this, which could have prevented perhaps a lot of this disaster and tragedy from what I've been reading.
Yes, I'm wondering about that myself. I read that India actually gave them a warning because they track the weather pretty well. And I have to say, just last week, I was tracking the cyclone from my office in New York, and I could see that 135-mile an hour wind was heading right toward Rangoon. So, you know, in their capital, Naypyidaw, where I believe there's 24/7 electricity and connectivity, somebody must have seen it coming. They didn't really need to be warned from outside.
So, in effect, would you agree with Professor Silverstein that this is sowing more seeds as far as resentment against the regime, not only because of their not putting out warnings, but the slowness of their response?
Absolutely. Almost every remark that we've heard from the ground was, I think, just what Professor Silverstein said. They seemed to be very quick at coming down when the monks were marching peacefully. And then when maybe hundreds of thousands might have been killed, we don't know. Nobody there. I also heard that some of the soldiers picking up the trees were being selected of whose houses and which offices they were clearing the debris in front of.
And we heard earlier from Richard Horsey about the difficulty of getting to these areas that are underwater and these inaccessible areas. And now we also have been apprised of the fact that those areas that were worst hit have had a postponement with respect to this weekend's constitutional referendum. How do you read the government's desire to get this thing, to continue making certain that this election goes forward?
We've heard that it's a very bizarre decision. You know, other countries, and they're not all democracies, postponed referendums and elections when natural disaster, not even this bad, hit. There's talk that Senior General Tan Shui may be just obsessed about this referendum, and not everyone agrees, because I'm told some military people are also baffled. You know, why are we doing this now? Because it's almost impossible to be doing something as massive as a referendum nationwide with this kind of calamity to also take care of. So hopefully, you know, there'll be maybe, wishful thinking, maybe there'll be some room for some, you know, disagreements with the top leader and, you know, maybe splits.
Maureen, always
hoping.
Maureen Aung Thuyen, again, is director of the Burma Project Southeast Asia Initiative of the Open Society Institute. What about the gouging that's going on in the wake of this? Gasoline, food, and selling water amid all this power outage? I mean, it's a horror show, but there's a lot of people who are obviously trying to make money.
Yeah, you know, it's like, you know, pot calling the kettle black, I guess. I think some of that happened in Katrina in the States, and in many disasters that seems to be what happens. There are always someone wanting to take advantage. In Burma's case, though, it is so awful. The people have just had this tremendous fuel price hike rise, and then the rice price rise, and so for everything to go up like several hundred thousand percent is unbearable even for a rich country, but it's disaster for Burma.
Well, the disaster in many people's minds has been, and I think you and Professor Silverstein have given testimony to this, has been exacerbated by the regime. This has been such a closed regime. I mean, borders have been closed, media has been closed, everything has been controlled by the military junta. But the opening up to aid, can that make a political difference?
Absolutely. I think they should. I hope that the more moderate elements, if there are such, will maybe, convince the number one to use this opportunity. This is their way out, if they want, or if some of them want out. You know, what happened in Indonesia is very, significant. When the tsunami hit there, and so many many more people were killed immediately. They used that. They didn't use that. They let in immediately the U.S. and the Australian Navy to come and help them because they needed immediate aid. And then the fight sort of went out of the civil war that had been going on there. So, in a way, this could be like the only little bright light in this disaster. They could use this if they wanted to, if they had the will.
Well, we're talking about the ongoing disaster in Myanmar, as well as the politics of the repressive military regime and the upcoming constitutional referendum. If you would like to join us with any questions or comments, we welcome your phone calls, and you can do that now toll-free at 866-733-6786. I want to open the phone lines and hear from you, our listeners. Again, it's toll-free, and you can join us now at 866-733-6786, or send an email. Our email address is forum@kqed.org. We spoke earlier with Richard Horsey, spokesman for the Regional United Nations Office for Coordinating Humanitarian Affairs in Bangkok and in Myanmar, and we spoke with him from Bangkok. And with us by phone now, Maureen Ong Thuyen, who is director of the Burma Project, and that Southeast Asia Initiative of the Open Society Institute. Joseph Silverstein is professor emeritus with Rutgers University, author of Political Legacy of Aung San and Burmese Politics, The Dilemma of National Unity, and he's with us from Princeton, New Jersey, and you can be with us as well, whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. We do welcome your calls now. It's 866-733-6786 or by email forum@kqed.org. We're hearing, Maureen Ong Thuyen, that at least 22,000 people are dead, hundreds of thousands homeless. These numbers are pretty hard to come by, as I understand, though.
Numbers are probably conservative. There's been some estimates from Thailand that's 45 and higher, and some others have suggested it could be, probably is going to be, it could be as high as 100,000 or more. People don't know. That's a very populated area, the lower delta there.
Professor Silverstein, you had something to add about those numbers?
Yeah, because the foreign minister has given his first report, and the numbers that Mr. Horsey quoted were his numbers, that of the 22,000 that they say have died, and 41,000 are missing, and that the one other thing that's important is the amount of aid that's already been offered or delivered. The Chinese were the first to land a plane with relief aid and a large stack of money that they gave to the Burmese. Right after that, we had India and Thailand both sending in air relief, one sending a plane load of rice, another one sending water and other products. I think it's important that people know how rapidly the world has responded thus far if we measure it in dollar terms. The United States gave $250,000. Now, that is small, but that's what the embassy has ready in its safe, so that we are positioned around the world to help out in emergency disasters like this. And we have already released that money to the Burmese, and there will be probably several millions following that.
Yeah, but the First Lady, as I said, who has taken a very significant role in all this, as Laura Bush has said, she doesn't know if that money will get through.
Well, that money's already been released because in the light of the criticism from the Australian Foreign Minister that we shouldn't be talking about politics in any way, the Australians have already donated their million, and Canada has released 2 million, and in fact, Australia has released 3 million, as I towed up the figures coming here. The European Union,
but the money
effectively is put in 3 million. So there is a flood of money. But the point that was made by Mr. Horsey, and I think Maureen and I have both been talking about, is We're talking about a devastated area with poor roads, and aircraft are small, and they can't carry a great deal. So no matter how much money you give them, money isn't going to feed people. You got to have rice. You've got to have other items, cooking utensils, wood, and what have you here.
You're also talking about a regime that is notorious for, Professor Silverstein, excuse me, regime notorious for its corruption. I mean, if you're going to get money through, you have to ask the question how much of that money is actually not only going to be converted into rice and other such things, staples that are going to be available to people.
A good deal of it will disappear. Yes, it always does. And in Burma, that's a special factor. But what is interesting is that all of them are talking about openness and that they want to follow up on where it's being directed and how it's going to be used. I think it's going to be a little harder for the military to pocket all that money. I think they're going to have to share a little of it, and they can't divert it all to weapons because they're not going to have the planes to bring it in.
Now, this is also, Maureen Ong-Twin, I want to hear your response.
Yeah, I just want to add to what Joe said about not being able to eat the money. I was told that the World Food Program had several hundreds of tons of rice already there inside Burma. I don't know if Richard Horsey mentioned this. I just got on. But you can't just, it's got to have vehicles to get it to the people who need it. So what is strange to me, I've been seeing on the state television, this Burmese state television, helicopter shots of the devastated areas, which is interesting. So obviously they've got some helicopters, so they're showing on state TV that the extent of the devastation.
Yeah, but at first on state TV in Myanmar, Burma reported 351 dead.
Of course.
Well, that was just a
guess. But at the uprising, they also said, and even 20 years ago, so... Yeah, but the fact that I think if they admitted to 22,000, it's got to be hugely more because that has to be, they're not going to, they don't like to air dirty laundry or any difficulty in front of the world.
Well, we're, again, inviting those of you listening to call us. We're coming up on a break, and I'd like to hear from listeners in terms of your response to this massively devastating cyclone that has hit Burma, which is the worst natural disaster since the tsunami back in 2004, but also to the ongoing concern about human rights and politics, a constitutional referendum that the government is behind. We welcome your calls for questions or comments. Again, it's toll-free, 866-733-6786, or you can join us by email. And our email address here is simply forum@kqed.org. We talked with Richard Horsey earlier, spokesman for the Regional United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, and he joined us from Bangkok, and we're talking with Maureen Ong-Thuyn, director of the Burma Project, Southeast Asia Initiative of the Open Society Institute, and with Joseph Silverstein, professor emeritus at Rutgers, who is the author of Political Legacy of Aung San and Burmese Politics, The Dilemma of National Unity. We're going to come back from the break and hope that you will become involved with any questions or comments that you have. Again, it's toll-free, whether it's by radio, internet, or Sirius satellite that we're reaching you, 866-733-6786, or send us an email, forum@kqed.org. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our focus this hour is on Myanmar. There was a devastating cyclone there on Monday. At least 22,000 people are dead and hundreds of thousands are homeless. And it is the worst natural disaster that we have seen since the tsunami and one of the worst in Asian history on the continent. Richard Horsey joined us earlier, spokesman for the Regional UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. And we're talking with Maureen Ong-Thuyn, director of the Burma Project, and that's the Southeast Asian Initiative. of Open Society Institute. And Joseph Silverstein is with us, also from Princeton, New Jersey. He's professor emeritus at Rutgers and the author of Political Legacy of Aung San and Burmese Politics, The Dilemma of National Unity. I'm going to go to your calls here in just a moment. Again, you can join us with any thoughts you have or anything you want to bring into the mix here in terms of this discussion or questions about the ongoing disaster in Myanmar, as well as, well, what some would perhaps appropriately call the disaster of the military regime and all the havoc that it's wreaked under that repressive actually right now Myanmar is one of the worst violators of human rights in the world, and the regime is one of the most repressive. You can join us toll-free at 866-733-6786 or by email forum@kqed.org. And before I go to calls or emails, I want to go to Ang Zwa, who is editor of Irrawaddy. Irrawaddy is actually based in Chiang Mai. It's a Burmese-run publication, but joins us this morning from Thailand. And we welcome you, Ang Zwa.
Thank you.
We're getting both assessment as much as we can about what's going on as a result of the cyclone, and also, of course, talking about the political situation there. I've been raising the question about maybe what Maureen Ong Thuyn called a bright light in all this, that it has. There's been so much exasperation and anger at the government as a result of their not acting forthrightly enough and not warning and not responding quickly enough, that it may mean, well, some more dissidents.
Well, that's right, and I think it could. We might see the some sort of more political dissent to the military government. That's why I've been telling the radio and television and radio station that even if the those who have died, who have perished in the waters, if they have a chance to vote for this coming referendum, they're going to vote for decisive. No vote for the referendum. So I think a lot of people are very angry. A lot of people are really mad at the government, military government, because there has been a very, very slow response to deliver the aid and assistance. There hasn't been, even today, no response and very slow response from the military to even deliver the clean water and food stuff and business items to assist the people. And even the amount of the people, the number of the people who died in the cyclone attack, I think the 15,000 people that the government was saying, could be much higher. I won't be surprised to hear 20,000, 30,000, 40,000 tomorrow, because of, I don't think the military government has any idea at all in the coastal regions and ARD territory, because of, we've been told by the victims of the cyclones who came to Rangoon and told us by phone, saying that 22 villages have been washed away, and because of all these houses and villages have been built along the rivers and on at the mouth of the sea, and when a storm hit these areas, they've been washed away and wiped out. So even in one village, 10,000 people disappeared.
Ang Zwa is editor of Irrawaddy. He's with us from Bangkok this morning. With the government so reluctant to release or disseminate information, what sources are you using to get information? Just people on the ground mainly? Or?
Well, it's extremely difficult. Let me tell you very honestly that on Friday, we put up the news of the coming the cyclone on the mainland Burma, and on Saturday it was a full-blown attack on Burma in the mainland Burma southern regions, and it was extremely difficult to establish contact with people on that region, even our stringer based in Rangoon. But on Sunday and today and Monday, it's getting a bit easier for us to talk to people. To our surprise, those some of the few victims of cyclone who escaped from the deadly attack and came to Rangoon, established contact with a lot of news agencies based outside of Burma, and talked to us and gave us some pictures of what happened to them and to these areas. So I don't think anybody has any idea and a clear picture of the damage at all, even though government has given a green light to the aid agency to deliver assistance. I think there is a negotiation going on. I don't think any agreement at all at the moment.
I wanted to ask you one more question about the upcoming election, which, as I said, is still scheduled for this weekend. But
it's not election.
The 24th, I mean the referendum, 24th of May, for those areas that have been particularly devastated, those remote areas were so difficult to get any kind of aid to. What I'm wondering is, even if there's an upswell against the government, can we expect anything resembling an honest brokered election and, I mean, referendum? And if that referendum comes out looking bad for the government, are we looking at maybe something like Zimbabwe?
Well, it's a good question because if people in Burma are given a free chance, a free and fair chance to vote, there will be decisive no votes. But before the cyclone slammed Burma, I think we all knew that the process will be cheated, the process will be manipulated. But now, I think the cyclone had changed the political dynamics in Burma. I repeat, it changed the political dynamics in Burma. So I think a lot of people are going to vote for no, and I think government is only partially holding the referendum in the northern part, which were not hit by the cyclone. So in the southern part of Burma, I think they're going to postpone 2 weeks. Even so, I think a lot of people who are very angry with the government, I don't think they are going to vote for the yes vote. So it will be very difficult for the military government to get a yes vote. But again, let me repeat, this is going to be cheated, this is going to be manipulated, and I don't know how the Burmese people are going to exercise freely in this process.
Aung Zaw is editor of Irrawaddy Burmese-run publication based in Chiang Mai, and he's joined us from Bangkok, and we thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
And we go to your phone calls now. We're going to continue with Maureen Ong Thuyen and Joseph Silverstein. And our first caller is Yun Myar. Good morning. Myar.
Hello.
Yeah, hi.
Hello. Yes, this is Myar from Sunnyvale. How are you?
Okay, thank you for calling. What can we do?
Well, you know, I'm actually very confused. There's so many deaths that have happened in Myanmar. And all we seem to be talking about on this show is how bad the government is and how bad the military rulers are and how incompetent they are. I mean, we are here in the United States. Worst thing happened in New Orleans. I mean, we had no idea what the heck was going on over there. I mean, how can we expect a country which is so backward and has all kinds of sanctions against it, that they'd have all the resources to know what's going on, where, and start blaming them rather than helping them out? I mean, even the numbers that we've talked about as being high numbers, $2-3 million. I mean, living in the Bay Area, I mean, you know, you can't buy peanuts for $2-3 million.
Well, it's a point. I think it's a point well taken. And Maureen Ong Thuyen, you had alluded before to Katrina and to the failure of this government to respond.
Yeah. What is it? Even in America, in this developed country, we had problems of, I think, lack of political will to go into Katrina as we now know, and that's why maybe the elections will turn out differently. And on the other hand, it was very difficult to reach. If you remember how all the you know, the people were standing on the rooftops and they had to do triage and whatnot. As far as the so-called poor military regime, I'd like to hear. I don't think we could just keep criticizing them. I think people have offered aid, but you know they're putting down conditions to receive that aid. They're saying, you know, just give us the money, we'll distribute. So you can't do that for international organizations who have certain guidelines. But the point I want to make is not a poor regime. They're making $1.5 billion, and it's not a now I'm just making a factual statement from the gas revenues, which are going all to Thailand to electrify Bangkok. So you know, these are monies that could have, I mean, I don't know what the regime has as far as, like, emergency equipment. How are the firemen equipped for emergencies, for even when there's not a cyclone, when things happen to poor neighborhoods? Are they prepared? I don't know. I doubt it. Because of the priorities that they've chosen to use what is actually a huge windfall in revenues. It's not a poor country. So I think it has more to do with governance and the government. I mean, as I said before, it's a great time to show, you know, show the world that you do care about your citizens and ask for aid and work together with the world.
Professor Silverstein, you want to weigh in here?
Yeah, I do. There's a lot that's being said that ought to be responded to. For one thing, the military has total control over communications. It has total control over the mobility of the people, and therefore we're the United States. People can move out easily when possible or helped in a variety of private ways. This is not a possibility in Burma. You have to depend only on the web because telephones are out. Electricity is totally out in the country. And this is the result of the military's total control, unwillingness to allow the people to participate in the ruling and the ordinary activities of their lives, but rather to be dependent on the military for fear that if you deviate, you're going to end up in jail. This is not a free society, and if you start with an assumption that, hey, they had trouble in New Orleans, so why should we talk about Burma? We have to talk about Burma.
Let me think.
This is so far the second largest cyclone that has hit in this area. In 1991, Bangladesh was hit by a cyclone that was larger than this one and lost over half a million people in that terrible event. This is something that the government has not prepared for. It has left the people unprotected. The police have not been trying to control and help to move supplies and emergency in and out of the area. They've left it largely up to whomever somehow could happen to come in, whether with an airplane or with a bicycle. The roads are inundated. Remember, there was a 12-foot surge of water that came in with that wind when it hit Burma. A 12-foot surge in an area where there are most of the buildings are bamboo and lightly protected. And this is the situation that people 4 days later find themselves with. There's no emergency relief coming in. And it is a country that totally has divested itself of responsibility to the people. It demands the people observe what they tell them. And if they don't, they'll be beaten and killed and put in jail. But they don't allow them to take any action on their own part to protect themselves. So we've got a situation here that is really wholly unique, much more so than even in Indonesia. At least the government had some responsibilities in some of the areas and helped out. We haven't seen that happen in Burma in the past, and we're not going to see it happen now. They're being forced to act, but they don't know how to act. They don't have the people ready with emergency equipment to give any kind of assistance.
Let me bring in more of your calls, John. You're on. Good morning.
Good morning, sir. Yeah, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, sure. I'm sorry to diversify the question. My question is, last time in 1990, this current junta, they either reneged or didn't honor the election result. And what makes the all of us, I mean the world or the people inside Burma, think this time the referendum or the future election would make any difference? Why we still have trust in that or still put a hope thinking that, hey, this election or this referendum might come out to be different? Wouldn't that maybe the rigged or whatever? So my question is to both Professor Silverstein or Ms. Maureen, yeah, whatever please have some comment or answer.
Well, before Maureen Ong Thuynh had indicated that there's maybe every reason to be suspicious of the way this referendum is being conducted, Joseph Silverstein, I'd like to hear what you have to add to that.
Well, first of all, what they're going to vote on is absolute power to the military. I don't know that anybody in his or her right mind that isn't being held with a gun to their head is going to voluntarily vote yes for this Constitution. Remember, the opposition to the no vote was no opportunity to use radio or to use newspapers or to do anything to mobilize, and the people resourcefully began to print T-shirts with only one word no on it, because they know if they speak out, there's a 5-year sentence in jail if they're caught. So as far as we look at this referendum, the referendum holds nothing for the people. We've got a new system of government that's going to be voted that will give 25% of all the seats to the military. The president will have to have 25 years of military experience in order to qualify for the job. The military budget and the military will be totally absent from any control by civilians, because they will not allow civilians to have any say in their budget or in their activity. And I could go on and on. This is not a democratic vote. This is a nonsensical vote. And people say it's better than nothing. I can't see we're better than nothing, given that they have nothing right now. They're not going to improve any because they're going to ensure that the military forever will rule the country, and that there will be nothing for the people to do but be slaves in that country.
Well, here's a mystery, though, in all this, and Maureen Ong Thuynh, perhaps you can address this. Here's a government that is known for its brutal, complete, repressive dictatorship, and it's having a referendum to give it more power, in effect, than it already has. I mean, the power is just about as absolute as it could be. This is what is this, just window dressing?
I'd like to first just a quick comment on the person who just asked about why does the world think, you know, why they even think they're not going to, you know, this is going to be a free election. I don't think anybody thinks it's going to be a free election. So the world does not think. But as Joe said, the people are actually being forced to vote. And I've heard all sorts of tales about, you know, Chinese visitors who are able to have the vote, and many other Burmese are not allowed to have the vote for various reasons, if they, you know, if they've had a trial or they've been indicted, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, but again, why is the government running this this show? I mean, what's it all about? What's their motivation?
Very simple.
Wait a minute. Hold on a second, Joe Silverstein. We're hearing from Maureen.
Just finish quick. I think at the bottom of all that, it may seem strange, they crave legitimacy as anybody does, as Mugabe does. Any dictator craves legitimacy. And this is one way they think they're going to get it, you see, by holding the gun, making sure that the vote yes comes through, then having elections, and they're going to negate the 1990, they think.
But legitimacy domestically or to the world?
No, to the world. Yeah. And domestically too, of course, but that's, you know, it's for both.
Yeah,
Professor, they have all the power, as you say, already. They don't
That's why it seems almost. Professor Silverstein, what do you want to add here?
Well, I wanted to say that legitimacy is what they crave for, and they will turn and say, the people voted this for us. This is the legitimate government. Nobody can challenge it. And as a result, their status in the world, which they've already said, is established because the United Nations recognized them. In Law 1/90, they said that the world recognizes them, therefore they are the legitimate government. Now, with a constitution that the people adopt, they will say the people have confirmed we are the legitimate government.
Well, the difficulty for many of us who have followed this government is sometimes just in what name to use. And Maureen Ong Thuynh, I mean, I don't mean to make light of this, but it certainly weighs on many people's minds. Do you call this nation Myanmar and therefore give it even more legitimacy by calling it what they want to be called, or do you call it Burma?
It's quite simple, actually. It's not incorrect in the Burmese language to either say Myanmar or Burma. It is not incorrect, right? But it is like having the whole world, force the whole world to say Deutschland for Germany. you know, in English. Now, of course, they use all sorts of excuses. That's the colonial name, whatever. But you can't just change a name, a junta just decide, we're going to change the name. Because, you know, if they wanted to call it Bagel, you know, the whole of Burma would have to call it Bagel.
That's the power of this regime, isn't it?
That's the power of this regime. And it's just become a political symbol of, you know, you've not had a referendum on a change of name of the country. You haven't asked the people who live there. So it's just become one of those polarizing. It's not incorrect, though.
Okay. I wanted to acknowledge, because in just a moment we're going to go to pledge, this morning the loss of philanthropist and forum benefactor Claude Rosenberg, who not only generously supported this program and believed in it, but was a good friend to me and a remarkable human being and really a world-class philanthropist. And just wanted to say we shall miss him dearly. I want to remind you that you're listening to an hour all about Myanmar in the wake of over 22,000 people dying, hundreds of thousands homeless after the devastating storm that hit on Saturday. And we were able to speak earlier with Richard Horsey, spokesman for the regional UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. He joined us from Bangkok. And we also spoke with an editor who is based spoke with us from Bangkok of a Burmese news outlet. And Maureen Ong Thuyn is with us, and she directs the Burma Project Southeast Asia Initiative. And we're also talking to Joseph Silverstein, professor emeritus at Rutgers and author of a couple of books on Burma, Political Legacy of Aung San and Burmese Politics, The Dilemma of National Unity. He's joining us from Princeton. And you are listening to Forum. We're talking about Myanmar. We're going to talk in the next hour with George Shultz and his partner in the book that he wrote all about reforming Social Security and Medicare. It's Joseph John Chauvin. And for more information about how to support KQED, simply go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And we get another caller in here, John from Mountain View. Good morning.
Yeah, I have a very different question. I'm a lot of respect for everybody scrambling for this disaster. But, you know, it's going to happen again with global warming and Bangladesh. And I've always had this fanciful idea that the American military has the ability to move huge amounts of food and material and people. And so I had envisioned the American military reorganizing itself over the next decade for massive humanitarian aid. But would that work in Burma?
Well, Joseph Silverstein?
No, absolutely not. No. The United States would not be allowed. No military, a foreign military, is allowed. Each one has to be given permission to come in and to go out. No, that would not be acceptable.
And you'd agree, Maureen?
Yes, under this government, no. In fact, I wanted to say that there's some UN aid people who I think have already been, you know, accepted to go inside, and they are waiting for their visas in Bangkok. They have not been issued, and they haven't decided, the government hasn't decided how to deal with all the bureaucracy that they usually do, you know, on goods coming in, should they charge custom taxes, all the protocol. Can you imagine thinking about those things at a time like this?
Well, let me thank John for his call, and I want to go to another caller. Wanda, good morning.
Yes. Good morning. I have a question about the history of the current Burmese government. I was under the impression that Chinese generals fled during the Communist Revolution into Burma, and essentially this is a second or third generation of Han Chinese leading the government and more or less in charge in the culture. Is that true? And could the gentleman from whose expertise is in that area, could he speak to that?
That's you, Professor Silverstein.
General Fan Shui is a Burmese. He is not a Chinese. If you were thinking of Ne Win, Ne Win also was a Burmese, but of mixed parentage. The rumors about China's power and role are quite true. The cities have become Chinese cities. Mandalay has been converted almost as Chinese wealth has come in, rebuilt the city, and has made it part of their area. It is not that far from Kunming. So, no, I certainly would not say what you're suggesting.
And let me thank Wanda for her call and go to Dwayne in Mill Valley. Good morning, Dwayne.
Uh, Quickly, I'd like to, Senator Feinstein is considering introducing legislation that would put 21 million Americans into voluntary national service under People's Lobby's American World Service Corps bill. It would strengthen such organizations as Peace Corps, AmeriCorps, Habitat, Doctors Without Borders, Head Start, et cetera. And I wondered what your group would think about having such legislation, because some of us feel that disasters are going to continue to increase in the future, and in addition to that, Americans' public policy IQ is pretty low. But if you had a million Americans a year serving over the next 27 years in such organizations as Peace Corps, AmeriCorps, Habitat, Doctors Without Borders, et cetera, and other organizations, then you could both deal with the disasters looming on the horizon and also get Americans involved, both at home or abroad, fixing Katrina, fixing Burma, or being involved in those kind of places. I wonder what their reaction would be to such legislation.
Thoughts on that, Maureen Ungswin?
Yeah, well, I like that. I mean, I like the idea of it. I think Americans over the decades have become too insular. The children are, you know, they come to school and they don't know their geography very well. I think this is a nice nonviolent way of, they call it, you know, soft power or whatever. But it's a way to engage with the world and help it at the same time.
Well, we've certainly engaged a lot of information this hour about an ongoing crisis, and we hope that things will be ameliorated as much as is possible, and that more information will get out about just how devastating this is, because clearly we're just getting part of the picture, and we will follow and continue to follow the story with respect to the referendum that's scheduled for this weekend, as well as the postponed vote over in the areas that have been particularly devastated. I want to extend thanks to Richard Horsey, who joined us earlier, spokesman for the regional UN office for coordination of humanitarian affairs, and to Ong Zaw, the editor of Irrawaddy, which is a Burmese-run publication, who also joined us this hour, and to the guests who are with us this entire hour, Maureen Ungswin, director of the Burma Project, Southeast Asia Initiative, Open Society, and Joseph Silverstein, professor emeritus from Rutgers. Again, his books are Political Legacy of Aung San and Burmese Politics, The Dilemma of National Unity. Also, our friends at the San Francisco Chronicle have a list of where you can help in Burma. We've posted a link on our website, which is simply kqed.org, www.kqed.org. I want to thank senior editor Dan Zoll and our producers, Kevin Guillory and Tina Lauerberg, our engineer Danny Bringer. Forum's executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Remind you that we will be back for another hour with George Shultz and John Chauvin. They've done a book called Putting Our House in Order, A Guide to Social Security and Healthcare Reform. You're listening to Forum, and for all of us at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.